This is Mission.org.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Marketing Trends and the Leeds Art Week.
Fraser Miller says his first love was product management, which allowed him to focus on the customer. He brought that love with him as he moved up the corporate ladder, and he taps into it frequently when devising strategy as the CMO of Reich. On this episode of Marketing Trends, Fraser discusses why he thinks that focusing on product fit is such an effective marketing strategy. Plus, he explains what it means to work in a high-velocity business. Enjoy this episode.
Marketing Trends is brought to you by Salesforce. We're bringing marketing and engagement together. Learn more at salesforce.com/marketing.
Here is your host, Ian Faison.
Welcome to Marketing Trends. I'm Ian Faison, Chief Content Officer here at Mission.org, and we have in studio, Fraser, what's going on?
Hey, how are you? Nice to be here.
Great to have you. We're going to talk some fun stuff about the one essential skill marketers are missing, which I love. We're going to be talking about being a high velocity CMO, what that means, building outbound motion, and much more. But first, how did you get started in marketing in the first place?
I love it. It's like the drum roll. I've had sort of an interesting career, I think, getting to the CMO role, maybe a little non-standard. But my original job function and really love as a function was in product management when I moved to the Bay Area. I worked at BEA Systems when I first moved here, and then I was at Yahoo for many years as a product manager. And I loved focusing on the customer and building great products and really embraced that function. And midway through my career, I had an interesting transition. I worked at SurveyMonkey for a little while with Dave Goldberg when he had taken over there. And SurveyMonkey was seeing a bunch of this traffic that they weren't capturing in and around online survey software. So it would be things like, what is an NPS survey? Or give me an example of a high school teacher survey, like long tail type queries, which they weren't ranking at all for. And so I came in really to help their product team figure out how to take advantage of that. And we ended up building a templates gallery so that customers could see a set of templates for different types of surveys.
I've used it. I've used many of those templates.
Right. And creating content strategies to help sort of explain. And the epiphany for me was that there's so many of the marketing teams and sales teams are focused on the funnel, right? Getting prospects in the top of the funnel and converting. But that there's this real opportunity to think more broadly about the customer journey and really the prospect journey and how you can add value at different steps along the way. And so I think, you know, the common term now is like design thinking, the trendy term that we use in marketing. But it, for me, it was an epiphany of like, hey, I can apply these product management skills into marketing teams and maybe think a little differently about how we can be doing marketing and sales. And so I pivoted my career at that point to work in more go-to-market teams and had an experience. I had an experience at startup Bloomspot where I had to build a sales team there. So that was a year of fun building an outbound sales organization. Eventually settled on this, what I call high velocity kind of marketing channels. I was at Articulate where I was held the role of COO and I ran sales and marketing. Marketing was really the core of that experience. And then eventually moved to Reich where I took the CMO role. But yeah, so it's for me, marketing and product management share a lot of commonalities. And I think the types of roles that I love and the businesses I love have that sort of product first orientation. And then marketing's really partnering close with product.
And that one essential skill, that design thinking aspect, you know, I love that, and you wrote a piece on this, which I really enjoyed, which is this idea that, you know, you can't necessarily just have, you know, right message, right customer, right time. You need to have, you know, this design thinking. What was kind of the epiphany there that you saw of seeing this need?
Yeah, I think it goes back to understanding some basic principles of understanding customers, and I'd say prospects. As marketers, we're really a lot of what we do is thinking about prospects. But you know, what does design thinking for prospects look like? If we just ask that question, it focuses you on what are the opportunities to provide value with someone that you don't already have a paying relationship with or some sort of relationship with. And if you kind of like put it in those terms, design thinking, we spend a lot of time with customers, with our products and delivering great products and services, you know, once they're down the funnel, right in there. But if you're really to force yourself, like before they're in the funnel, what are the ways that we can, we can add value? An example that just pops to mind at Articulate, we serviced instructional designers, it's the e-learning profession. We've all taken these courses and generally they're painful. They can be painful to go through these courses. Oftentimes they're compliance driven and legal teams putting them out or whatever. And once you get into the course, it's like they're rate limited. So you can only get through, slides so quickly. You're just waiting to get to that quiz to get through it. And it actually ended up being this amazing market to sell into because those customers, those prospects are very aware. They're teachers, basically. They're trying to create great materials for their students.
Yeah.
And they're very aware. They get the feedback all the time from their students of like, can you build more entertaining e-learning? Because it blows.
Yeah.
And so we sort of just took the approach of like, hey, let's be the empathetic brand for these instructional designers. And what are all the ways like we can help just in this profession? Of course, we have software that can help build, great e-learning, but there's a lot of things way upstream that is needed. We invested a ton in the content team, the community team to create best practices and tips around this. I mean, this, kind of standard operating procedure for a lot of businesses today. But, one of the things that we built there, we spent a lot of time on the community and creating that community that was branded separately from Articulate. But one of the things in the design thinking realm is these instructional designers are constantly trying to find their next career in the next post, and or their teams may be growing and they're trying to post. There's no real job board for instructional designers. So we built a jobs board as part of eLearning Hero, and it was one of the most successful things we did. It had, not a lot to do with selling e-learning software. Yeah. But it's the idea of like, how would we design something to really help add value as early as we can in this segment or in this target group's lives?
Yeah, I think about that a lot with like this show. And we just recently got an email from one of the listeners that they listened to the episode with Katrina Wong, the VP of marketing at Hired. And she's like, oh, yeah, her husband's an engineer. And, like, you should go check out Hired. And her husband got a job from listening to Marketing Trends. But yeah. I always think about that stuff. And I talked to producer Ben about this, about like, how do we make it like more than a show? Like, yeah, people come listen for the marketing content. They stay for the relationship, stay for the friends along the way. But I always think about this, like, just because you're making something that has one use, like people are going to use it for whatever thing that they want. Maybe it's a, companion to hang out with and talk about marketing, but maybe it's like to get a job, or maybe it's, you coming on the show to find jobs for your friends or whatever it is. And I always think that like marketers kind of need to stretch what their thinking is of like what the tool that they're creating and how people are going to be solving it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think being creative about what category you're in. And I think there's always opportunity to kind of bring a heightened awareness or definition around who you're serving and what value you're playing.
Or what they need. But this is one of the things you're saying with the job board. And one of the big takeaways from, our first 100 episodes of Marketing Trends was your company has advantages, has like little secrets and things hidden that like nobody knows about, usually by your customers or how they use the product or whatever it is. But you can share those with the world and it makes killer content.
Yeah.
Like those are the type of things where it's like, well, the thing that's really useful to your customers was like this job board.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a great example. For example, because data, you can do this a lot with data. A lot of these companies are, especially in a high velocity where you have tons of customers and lots of data flow in the systems, that can be extremely useful, obviously internal, but also externally. I'm thinking about that. That famous blog post or site that MailChimp put together on open rates, email open rates.
Oh, yeah.
You've probably seen it, right? We all looked at it at the day, but they had enough data to understand sort of by industry, by campaign type, what you would expect to see email open rates to be. It added a ton of value. It created, put a lot of people in the top of the funnel, so to speak, or maybe they weren't in the funnel, but it was just good, you know, goodwill towards the industry. And so I think there's a ton that companies can be doing with data if they think about that and how to push that out to help their category.
Yeah, we spoke to Ryan Benici, the CMO of G2 Crowd, about this, about one of the tools that he created, which I always am fascinated by marketers creating tools in like as part of a campaign, mm-hmm. like actually just build the thing, like mm-hmm. build whatever it is. I love the clicks CPM calculator. Like mm-hmm. how many times have I used that CPM calculator? Yeah. And it's like stuff like that, I just think is so easy to do, like to execute once you have.
But it's not always obvious, right?
No, yeah.
It's not
yeah.
always obvious. You got to sort of think a little bit outside the box.
And like have the capacity to do it, which is the other thing.
Yes.
To like have someone on your team. So you need low code tools to be able to build that stuff. So you mentioned high velocity. So like, what do you mean by a high velocity business?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of this segment. And in a lot of ways, I've focused my career in what I think of as high velocity businesses. And you can think of these as channels if you're a larger business, because you have multiple channels. But most of the companies I've worked with are startups or scale stage, privately held. And you've got one primary way you're going to market. But these high velocity businesses, in my mind, tend to have the characteristics of a lot of volume coming into your site or into the top of a funnel. There's various ways that happens, but tend to be high volume. They tend to have low price point in terms of the product or service that you're offering. They tend to be very product oriented. Customers tend to like know, if you take kind of SurveyMonkey as an example, you know, customer, they did exceedingly well ranking both organic and as well as paid on online survey software. That became a big category, lots of search intent around it. But it was sort of very product-oriented journey of trying to understand what are the features of this relative to other competitors out there. And they also tend to be churny businesses, right? They're sort of like large, oftentimes just serving kind of bottom of the pyramid or value-oriented customers. And
easy to buy, easy to leave.
Easy to buy, easy to leave, right? So the relationships can be, or at least start out in a kind of tentative way. And it's funny, this, you know, if you rewind the clock a few years ago, these businesses were, when I was working at SurveyMonkey, for example, there was a lot of question marks about whether this part of the SaaS segment would ever succeed. There weren't really any examples. I mean, you had the Salesforce, you had this sort of enterprise software, large ACVs, you know, significant relationships, but these lighter weight relationships really weren't a favor. And I think it's interesting now with Zoom coming out, Slack coming out, the success of, you know, MailChimp. There's a bunch of really great companies now that are in this, what I see as like a high velocity business.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of the episodes that we do on the show are around B2B, and a lot of those conversations historically are top down driven, like institutional change type products. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these are like bottom up, mm-hmm. you know, user group, segment group, things mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. Small group of people. So it's like, and then the CIO wakes up one day and is like, wait a second, like how many licenses are we yes, selling to yes. this? Like, right. We have like 35 licenses, but it's across 10 different teams. Like what's going on here?
Yeah.
And you're right. It's just a very different thing.
You know, I think as I think about some of the industry trends, obviously the advent of the internet and online buying has really shifted way people purchased before. When Benioff was starting his business, there wasn't like the prevalence of everyone getting all this data and buying online. And yeah. so you had to make a giant claim in terms of here's the category we're going after. It's very top down. But, you know, certainly the advent of that, I think also a lot of these products just becoming a lot better to use and easier to use and easier to try out. And, you know, Slack is the poster child of like consumerization of the enterprise, a great, elegant product. Stewart had built two B2C, you know, companies beforehand and really had that product sensibility. Bringing that into the enterprise has helped. And then I think also, you know, we've had the the SMB, the kind of SMBs coming online or sort of purchasing software at an unbelievable rate, right? 10 years ago, they were just buying QuickBooks and maybe a couple other point solutions, but now you have SMBs who really see the value of a bunch of different. So I think all of these are contributing to like giant opportunity for these high velocity businesses to be more successful.
Well, and I think you have like platform plays and multiple play, like obviously, you know, Salesforce, who sponsors the podcast and we love them, but you have like app exchanges and you have like all these other things. So you can plug into, you know, things like that. And then you have other companies who have platforms. And then you also have like best of breed services where it's like, you can plug certain things in, you know, in other interviews where you talk about like this idea, it's like, hey, if you want to go try some, you know, new MarTech or whatever it is, it essentially just plugs right into all of the stuff that you're already doing with integrations and APIs.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can get it up and running right away.
Right.
And like that stuff didn't all, the architecture didn't exist.
That's right. And one of the definitions I put out there, this piece I just wrote, was that the services or configuration is basically non-existent or very lightweight. And that's an important point that you can easily onboard and get this thing up and running. On the flip side, you're right, these businesses aren't easy to, there's downside too, right? You mentioned the relationship with customers can be more lightweight. People can get in and out a lot quicker. So churn is a real thing on these businesses. And that was one of the reasons why a lot of people felt like, you know, this segment's not, can't take off is because they're too, gross churn was too, you know, was too loud. But
yeah, I mean, I think Jason Lemkin talks about like there's no such thing as churn. There's just people who quit your product. like it's not this giant, like it's not a, you know, you're not churning butter. It's like literally just people quitting you.
Yeah.
And I always think that that's a funny way of looking at it. But because you have a price point potentially that's extremely low and, you know, cost to join, like the whole lean startup 101 for so long was like, make sure that someone is buying your stuff. They will actually give you dollars to do it. But it's like when your price point is $7, you know, or whatever it is, then they can try it really easily. And it's actually not like they're really spending that much money. Yes, technically they need to like swipe their credit card and things like that. So I'm curious, as you have, you know, built multiple high velocity businesses, how did you approach that from a marketing standpoint? How did you get that person? How did you identify those folks that it's like, they're not that serious of a buyer? Like, what are the gates that they need to go through to be like, oh, this is a serious person? Because when you're projecting churn to, you know, as you're a CRO, COO, to the CEO or to the board, and you're saying like, hey, we signed up all these people, but you're like, this segment of, you know, 17% of these people, I can tell pretty quickly that they're actually not serious buyers for long term or whatever. I'm just curious, how did you look at that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you sort of, my mind sort of immediately went to sort of where yours did, which is understanding different segments within your population. And I think that's a key element of success for high velocity businesses is that you're going to get a lot of people in the funnel. It needs to be that way for it to be high velocity and for the low price points to work. And really understanding all the different, they're not all going to be one flavor, right? You're going to have different types of people and you can end up fretting a lot with this percentage of customers that come in and like don't do what they're supposed to do in the product, don't get it up and running. And, you know, it may be that that segment is not a good fit, right? You should fire those customers, that type of mentality of like, we don't care about these customers, but it's these other customers, which, you know, they do the right set of things, but then they're like week two, they don't get back on, but they've invited the five friends and they showed initial interest. That segment is really important for us to go after. And in fact, it's like onboarding. We got to do a better job with onboarding these guys. They don't have the tools to really know how to get to the next step. So I think that's, you know, that's one element of it. And thematically, I think in high velocity, it's a very data oriented world. And having the kind of discipline to build that metric orient, I mean, it's sort of, you know, over we sort of all talk about data orientation marketing, but really in the high velocity one, you have enough scale oftentimes in these businesses to be able to take kind of a data oriented approach. And two, it ends up being really important to understand what's happening with your business, to have that business operations function that is segmenting your customers, understanding, you know, CAC to LTVs by segment, you know, by channel, by ad group, and really understanding where are you picking up valuable customers in your acquisition attempts? What are the opportunities to, you know, plug the funnel as you go down, because they tend to be leaky funnels, and who's going to not just stick around, but evangelize and upsell and cross sell. You have to really understand that whole picture, and it looks very different across segments of customers.
What I'm curious, like, we've seen a lot of kind of like this anti-funnel mentality. You have obviously like
the flywheel.
Yeah, flywheel. Or like even inbound, or, you know, flipping your funnel, you know, rise of ABM, things like that, which for a high velocity business, like, does that stuff make sense?
I think, yeah, you know, yes and no. I think there's a lot of merit to the flywheel. I think the constructs are mainly important to emphasize a point, right? That it's not just like a linear path. To me, the flywheel is like, it's not just a linear path from start to finish. And there's multiple ways that you need to think about the relationship with the customer. There's a couple of things that I think to touch on there. In high velocity businesses, you do need, if we take more enterprise software approach, they call new logo acquisition, right? You know, use that in high velocity businesses, but you need a lot of new people coming in just to, I think, to continue. I think of these businesses as engines, and like the engine has a big acquisition component to it. You're sort of, it needs fuel to come in the form of leads and top of funnel. There's lots of ways to drive that, but the funnel construct, I think, works well for that acquisition side, and really thinking about the ways that people are leaking out and being on top of your conversion rates. And there's a lot of science there that kind of makes sense for high velocity. I will say, though, a super important element that we touched on was that it's leaky not just through the funnel, but post transaction as well. And this is basically churn. Yep. And so that's where this kind of the idea of the flywheel, which is there are these periods, onboarding period is something that I think a lot of marketing teams kind of miss, because they pitch it over to CS or expect product to handle it. But marketing, totally, I think, really needs to be focused on that first 30 days and 60 days, and all the data supports that. And then upsell. That means a lot of the businesses will be monthly plans, but I think more and more the high velocity can do annual or some mix of both. And making sure that a lot of times your price point and unit economics for a one-year deal, or to stay on the base plan, or heaven forbid if it's freemium, the CAC to LTVs don't work really well. So you really are counting on that expansion. And, you know, one of the motions that I think is really popular and makes a lot of sense is this land and expand emotion for high velocity businesses.
Yeah.
So that's where the marketers really need to think about it as a flywheel. And one of the mistakes I see a lot of these businesses making is just focusing on the funnel of the acquisition and not thinking about onboarding, not thinking about expansion. Marketers tend to think about evangelism, which is like, what are our key customers and how do we get them out talking to people, which is part of a longer relationship. But so I do think there's a lot about the flywheel that works in high velocity.
Well, I think also high velocity businesses, you have things like G2 Crowd and all sorts of Owler and whatever else. Accelerating word of mouth is like a huge piece of this, because if you're in a high velocity business, by and large, like, you have a, you know, blank point blank out of 5 stars somewhere on the internet that someone is going to be looking up about you. It's not necessarily like, you know, enterprise like Gartner or Forrester or whatever it is. Like, people don't care. They're like, do other people like this? And then they're going to ask their friends and colleagues. And I don't know if I stole this or not, but I always think about it as like, you know, if you're spending 90% of your resources on acquisition and then 10% of your resources on retention, it's like, you're probably going to get really good at acquiring people and really bad at retaining people, right? Like, it's just a function of, you know, organizational effort. And I think that was kind of one of the missteps of a lot of that stuff, which was kind of this idea that you could say, well, we'll probably get better at, you know, retention because we could like work on that, but we need to invest on acquisition. And it's like, it's, you know, and it might be true for some businesses and not true for others. Did you find that there was a way to accelerate word of mouth to, and even before that, to like accelerate adoption from a marketing standpoint by investing like time or resources into that piece of it versus just on like the acquisition.
On the, you're saying on the word of mouth and referral, like how do you drive that?
Well, like how do you, how do you even get to that?
Yeah,
like, right. How do you get from like, you know, closed deal to even that point? Cause that's the chasm, right?
Yeah.
It's like once they're ready to, you know, give a referral, it's like, they're probably pretty ready,
but
getting through to that part is really difficult.
I mean, I think one thing I'd say is that so much of this, this sort of goes back to my career path. So I think I believe so much of the success of these businesses comes back to product. Is the product a delightful experience? And I think as much as marketers, we, you know, can market in and around that, there's orders of magnitude, you know, impact of having a great NPS score versus like a not great NPS score. So that sort of goes without being said. But I think, you know, as I think about my career, I try to really look at what are the product dynamics here, and are customers going to be delighted and love this? Or is there some segment of customers that's going to be delighted and love this? And then I think, you know, I think marketing's job is really to one, make sure you understand your USPs and where you differentiate so you can get those types of customers in, right? So marketing's role is to really be smart about where is this going to fit? Where is going to be the segment or the population that's going to be delighted by that? And then being able to tell that story. And I think part of what I see as the marketing team job is to get them through that prospect journey queued up for having a great experience, and then making sure that you don't drop the ball post-transaction, which I see time and time again, where you're not one, that organization's not clear about the role product is playing versus CS versus marketing.
Yeah.
And where does education go? And marketers, you know, another example of things that I think we don't do well is marketers will tend to want to tell customers how things should get onboarded or how they should use the product. You send them an email sequence, you build a university that has great videos, but it's so much more compelling to do that in the product. How many people go to the university and like listen to all the videos on how to do it? You have to be really motivated to get this up and running. And there's all these opportunities within the product to do that, but the product managers aren't usually thinking about that first experience and that out of the box experience. So this is all by way of saying getting across that gap you talked about from a new customer to someone who's willing to refer and evangelize, but doing the basics there that make sure you're getting the right types of customers and they're as successful as you can get them to be in that first period of time, I think is a lot of the battle.
Well, I think I'm just curious how many people are marketing post-sale about marketing adoption things instead of just marketing buy now, because that's what I think is so, like, I get an advantage to interview a lot of people and products, many of which we use here at Mission. And what's funny is, like, you learn things about the product when you're talking to people in the company sometimes. And like, most people don't have time for that. But I always think about like certain features that are fun. And actually, you know, we've talked, you know, about Slack a lot, but one of the things that Slack does great at is all these like little weird things that happen with Slackbot or whatever it is. Promoting those is like keeps it front of mind. It keeps it top of mind. I'm just curious, like how much marketing budget is not spent on evangelizing post-sale, like implementation type things? Because I think that those sort of things like are kind of like the heartbeat of the product in a lot of ways. And it's like, I don't know. I think that there's something there that I don't really see a lot of, but there are ways to get in front of your customers, you know, even in just your regular marketing activities.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what you're highlighting is the I'd say the marketing and product relationship from a functional standpoint, as well as just from a sort of who's doing what, but it oftentimes is that PM that has a natural sense of marketing savvy of how are, you know, how is this product going to sort of show itself up on in a demo, for example, or how do you add that whimsy, right, that Slack did where it's going to be, you know, compelling really early on in your
like
first
showing how people use the products. Like I always, we talk about our Slack channel, hashtag dogs at Mission. That's like all the photos of all of our employees' mm-hmm. dogs and stuff. And now that our customer success manager, Catherine, now is a wag walker. So she shows other dogs now, which is pretty great. But things like that, like little ways that other companies use your product that are fun or cool or creative, or cool companies that do that to show like, oh, hey, I use the product and I don't do that. Like, yeah. Oh, you know that product that we don't really use that much, like that I was thinking of canceling? Like, I didn't realize it did this. Like little things like that, little reminders. And the reason why I'm getting to this is like, there are marketers who are listening who don't have a high NPS, who don't have, you know, as high of a score on something like G2 Crowd, that don't have those advantages and can't tout that. Well, what can you tout? Like, what are the things, where can you fight and win on something that can keeps you front of mind for people who have already bought so that they don't churn out?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of opportunity, you know, that marketer, what we're highlighting here is there's a lot of opportunities that of putting stuff into the product that will help gain traction, right, with your customers or a core segment. And, you know, sometimes those are whimsical, sometimes they're just super useful, right? Really nailing some pain point that your customer base could have, going back to the jobs board as an example. It wasn't even in product, right? But it's really understanding the customer and what are real needs that they have that no one else has serviced. And I think, you know, so part of this maybe is back to what we were saying, is being creative thinkers as marketers of how you define your journey, you know, and there's stuff in the product you can do, and there's perhaps stuff outside of the product, which marketers will be able to control, you know, more of. One of the reasons I really like these high velocity businesses is because marketers, we haven't talked about sales at all, you know, to date. What are we, you know, 30, halfway through this interview, we haven't talked about sales. And, you know, I have a high degree of respect for sales teams, and I think they really play an important role in most of these high velocity businesses. But one of the reasons they're great for marketers is because marketing is driving, you know, so much of the revenue, and you can sort of track marketing's influence from the very early days through to not just transaction, but also cross-sell, upsell. And you kind of have to do it that way because it's a more efficient spend typically than, you know, hiring people. And so back to the point of like, marketers need to see themselves as driving, you know, in these types of businesses, really have a role to play within the product strategy and with the CS strategy and with your operation strategy and with finance. And one of the reasons I've gravitated to these businesses in my career is because you have to be able to think really in all these dimensions of the business to be, I think, to be successful. And so anyway, back to your point, I think marketing, you can't just get off the hook by saying, hey, our NPS is low, you know, in these types of businesses, it's like marketing's got to own why is it low and how can we be doing a better job of getting the right customers in and building the right product.
Well, let's figure out how to get some new logos in. Let's build some outbound motion here. You know, if I have a magic wand, because I host the show, so I do. And I'm going to make you CMO of a new company. Like, how would you look at building an outbound motion, creating strategy around this, evaluating different channels and all that?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, let me maybe define the context of outbound, because it can mean, I think at a new company, outbound motion, I'm not sure that I'm the right guy to go solve that, but it's, what's that?
This company, we're making this company up, but it's been around, amount of years.
I guess, you know, here's what I know about outbound, because outbound's, I think, a very deep topic. In a lot of these high velocity businesses that I've been part of, you get to a point where you've hopefully grown nicely and your growth path is doing well, but you get to a point where it's either the investors will come in with this idea or you need another gear in your engine to increase growth. And so inevitably it comes back to sort of hey, let's do outbound, right? Everyone's the current thing. And it's something that sounds good and sounds easy to do, but my experience has been, it can be very hard to, especially if you're in a business that has this current motion that's inbound focused and very sort of driven by marketing, to layer on a real outbound.
It reminds me of the car, the sport, or maybe it's not a sports car. In this case, we'll say it's like a conversion van, but it's like a van and we're rolling really, we're going 80 miles an hour And then you have the big ramp and you drive off the ramp and you land on like the tanker that's like out at sea that's like going to take you out. And it's like this car that was like flying super fast and you hope that you land. But if you land on it, like everybody gets out and you realize you're like, we're actually going pretty slow right now. And it's like, we were just going super fast and we had all this control and we could move the wheel. It's on the fly, by the way. This is a great analogy.
It's good. I like it.
But yeah, that's kind of what it sounds like
you're right,
to me.
You're right. Yeah, so you got a high velocity motion of this like fast, like race car that's landing on a kind of tanker, right? That's hard to get up and running and going. I think there's a lot of merit to that analogy. I mean, a few things that I would say in my experience with Outbound, you have to be, I'll share this experience. You probably heard this from others, but one of the company I was at, we had a low price point, high velocity product. It was being bought up in a lot of Fortune 100 companies. And when we went and looked at like, hey, let's go do Outbound, we saw Fortune company X, I remember it was Accenture in this case, had like 100 installs of our product. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this is a great opportunity. We just need to go find the right C-level person and tell them like, you want to buy our enterprise license. So we went out and we hired some folks and we tracked down the right decision makers and had the conversation with them. And they said, wow, we have 50 licenses here. It sounds like we should be getting a discount. And to which we said, well, don't you want some more licenses? And they said, well, I don't really know, but like we're spending a lot with you guys. You want to like have a discount. So the purpose of the story is like it was a margin contracting exercise, right? Yeah. Our outbound motion was actually doing the exact opposite as we wanted to do. And my takeaway with that was you need to know you have a product that you can sell and that sustains the economics you need for outbound, which is very different. And one way to think for marketers to think about this or businesses to think about it is like you're almost in a way trying a new product market fit. You have product market fit, right? With a certain market or certain type of buyer, but don't fall into the trap of saying, oh, well, we just need to go apply some like SDR resources into this and like we'll be able to sell it, you know, way higher up the food chain. You really need to go back. What we did in this company's case, we went back, we had these conversations like what would an enterprise product look like that would help service? No surprise, it was a lot of administration capabilities. Yep. It was a lot of security, a lot of the illities that you talk about. And so we went back and took about 12 months. It was over a year to build a Teams product. It wasn't even really a full enterprise product, but we created a product roadmap and we put the brakes on our outbound efforts until we had that product. And then we went back out and it was much more productive and it's much more strategic to be like, hey, you have these 50 licenses. Wouldn't you like to manage these? Because you have people leaving and the licenses are just sitting on the floor with, you know, the unspent, you'd love to like reassign them to someone else. Yeah, that sounds interesting. Okay, well, this Teams product is 40% more than our base product, right? So that you have the economics that support the go-to-market motion.
I love that story. That's great. And it reminds me that a lot of times when you have the high velocity business that you kind of just like, you know, slap on the sales team, the commission structure, and all that stuff. And you're like you said, it fundamentally changes the unit economics of the product. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wait a second, like, you know, we're doing 10% out the door every time we sell this, plus floating those salaries, plus like whatever. Like, wait a second. Like,
we have to be selling this at 10 times what we're currently selling, right? To make this work.
And yeah, you're like, wait. And then it's like, we were priced in the market at this point for X, Y, and Z. Did we forget why we were kind of priced at that point or whatever? Yeah. Were there any other mistakes that kind of like happened around that as you structure? I mean, it's clearly you had the ear of a lot of important people during that conversation, but were there any fights that you had to kind of deal with that restructuring or figuring that out?
I mean, yeah, I think one of the things I counsel folks, especially in these high velocity business going outbound, is you have to be patient with it. It's and you have to help set expectations of the board because there are some companies who have the right product that they can do this, but all we know all sort of products aren't created equal. And so the bottom line is it's going to take longer than you think, and it's going to be more expensive than you think. I think as a CMO, be very careful before you go sort of proposing that this is a solution for your growth woes, unless you really know what you're talking about, because it's going to take a while to find the right next motion to go after. There's a lot of heartache about that. I think the philosophy of starting small and trying to test a couple of different small motions to see if those are working, I think makes a ton of sense, so you don't get over your ski tips and you know, make promises you can't deliver on. One of the ways it tends to be easier for high velocity businesses to go outbound is really focusing on the land and expand. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a semi outbound, and a lot of people will define it as outbound, but it's really not, because you're working with an existing count footprint. It's kind of what we did in that example that I brought up, but it's a softer way where you already have a relationship and hopefully the product is doing well. You have metrics to be able to see that, and then being strategic about what are the expansion strategies for us to be able to move into other parts of the company. And that can be a lot easier. The challenge with the board I have found is it's hard to measure, like, what is really outbound. And so I spent a lot of cycles with CFO and the board's like, okay, this incremental dollar that we're spending to try to sort of find this other motion, well, you deployed it with an existing account that already was happy with our products and was eager to introduce you to other people. Like that doesn't feel outbound to me.
Yeah, no kidding, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's
definitely not cold, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not cold. And so in this example, we spun up a separate group, and was one of my learnings just to be able to make sure you're testing, you have the right sort of experiments set up, is like, okay, we're going to get a named logo list of no one that is on our list right now. It's going to be this type of ICP. We kind of figured out our ICP, and it was a much more traditional, like, outbound approach to it. And that was freaking hard. I mean, it was just hard, especially when you have a low price point product and you're trying to convince them to buy 1,000 of these seats, not just, hey, because the conversation inevitably is like, I see in her site, I can get going with 5 seats here. So it's, you know, anyway, I think that the learning is being really clear about the type of outbound you're going after, trying to be smart and intentional about what has the greatest chance of success, and setting up your tests in a way that just like, here's what success looks like. We're going to spend this amount of dollars. We expect this amount of like incremental ARR. Maybe it's to come out of existing accounts and it's an expansion strategy. But
well, and that's where you say, you know, hey, maybe we repurpose 2 product marketers as sales reps and A/B test those 2 people or customer success people or whatever they were, and like let them try to sell the product to new accounts, like to brand new accounts, instead of like hiring a head of sale or VP of sales and, you know, 5 regional managers and like segment the entire world and like do all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And try to boil the ocean.
Yeah. And it's like, there's lessons there. I remember one of the mistakes we made was when we started going outbound, you know, the natural thing is, well, let's find our best sales guys that are killing it on our inbound side. They know this product so well. And like, let's put them on some big accounts and go whale hunting. That was like the worst thing to do, because we took our best guys and put them into like, a totally different motion where they're expected to have conversations with a completely different level.
Super long sales cycle.
Super long sales cycle. And it sounded cool because the commissions are super big, but they were not the right people to do it. They ended up falling on their face, you know, and so you're taking your best people and then hanging them out to dry. And so it's like, okay, you go back to the job you're good at. We need to hire some people who have done this before. And then it's, you know, then it's challenging because you're spending capital, you're hiring people, you're creating teams that is, you know, it's hard to get those experiments up and running. There's a lot at stake. The other thing that you may have talked to other CMOs about, but I've found to be really valuable on outbound, is marketing owning the SDR.
Yeah.
So I know there's a lot of debate on that. My quick summary for that would be, I think SDRs, as part of the marketing organization, the advantages that I see is perhaps most importantly that, you know, sales and marketing are always trying to work more closely together. When you have the SDR function in marketing, it really forces that tightness that you need for marketing to be able to try to launch messaging with SDRs. SDRs trying it and like not working and being able to come back and talk to marketing is like, this is not working at all. Email cadences is another great thing. We have all these great tools like Outreach and others that lets SDRs and sales send email, but marketing typically, especially if it's in a different organization, has no idea like what's going out the door and like what's working and how do we A/B test this. So by having the SDRs, we tried it both ways, but having the SDRs in marketing really, again, if you think of this as product market fit, you don't really know where the product market fit is with this new segment you're going after. Having that fast cycle time and that tightness of execution, I thought was much better done in marketing than in sales.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking to the Pardot folks about like, you know, like intelligent lead scoring and all the cool stuff with AI and all of this. And it's like, I think it's however you figure out how to like, you know, split the band or whatever it is that that you do, it's so clear that like the rubber meets the road at the SDR function. Like, yeah. I mean, we all get hit up by SDRs all the time. It's like super freaking annoying. So it's like, if you're losing institutional bandwidth on just annoying people, like that ain't good. Like if, you know, so, and then conversely, it's like, if your messaging doesn't align and you're using, you know, that type of structure on like, you know, extremely important accounts or whatever it is, like,
it's just
it's a tricky piece to get right.
Super hard to get right. And you know, the counter argument, the SDRs, is their career path is on the sales side. So sales wants them. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. They're not going into marketing, but I think you can still keep the career path into sales, but have them sit in marketing. So you have your dailies every day, you know, really making sure you're not burning these great customers, making sure you're not annoying people and really getting marketing kind of skin in the game and the motion.
I mean, and I think that the reverse is also true. It's like maybe, I mean, we've talked about like, you know, the ability to do ride-alongs and things like that, but it's like probably having sales sit in on marketing and marketing sit in on sales like more often is good in general anyways. Yeah. So it's like training, you know, salespeople who have a clue about marketing is great and vice versa is great. Like if your product marketers aren't sitting on sales calls ever and you don't hear how your customers talk, like that's not good either.
Yeah. I wish CEOs really understood that better, because you get on a job, you know, and it's like you want to perform right away, and really marketing should just spend a month carrying quota, you know, trying to get ramped up. You learn, you have such a better perspective, right, when you do that and vice versa. But it's, you know, everyone nods their head, yeah, that's the right thing to do, but then no one really makes it happen like it should.
All right, let's get into lightning round questions. These questions are fast and easy, just like marketing automation with Pardot. You can go to pardot.com/podcast to learn more about B2B marketing on the world's number one CRM. That is Salesforce. We love Pardot. I always say we love Pardot. It's not even in the read. I just love them. Shout out to our friends at Pardot. If you haven't checked them out, go check them out. They support the podcast. Instrumental to the podcast. Lightning round questions. Fraser, are you ready?
Yes.
Number one, what app are you using on your phone that is the most fun?
I'm liking Calm right now.
Ooh, Calm's great. Favorite vacation spot?
I just went to the Dolomites in Italy with my family. Can't recommend it highly enough. Great vacation, great hiking, and amazing food.
Favorite thing to cook or eat?
I guess I'll go with salmon, fresh caught salmon.
Favorite book or podcast that you've read or listened to recently?
I am reading These Truths by Jill Lepore. It's a great book about U.S. history.
Hidden talent or passion?
I am passionate about kiteboarding. I guess it's not too hidden. I love paintball.
Oh, that's a good one. Best advice for a first-time CMO?
Focus on the mission.
Not this company, but like the mission.
Not my company. I love your guys' name, by the way.
Thank you.
I just think mission is, as a CMO, to be able to come in and really embrace and extend the mission gives you a lot of power and aligns you with the company and makes your team feel great. That'd be my top piece of advice.
What question do you never get asked that you wish you were asked more often?
How should I raise 3 boys?
How should you?
A lot of sleep. Make sure they have enough food.
Would them get a lot of sleep or you get a lot of sleep?
Well, both, ideally. Usually it's not me getting a lot of sleep. It's the boys getting sleep, making sure they have enough food and keeping them off the technology and their phones.
Good advice for anyone, actually, all of those things. This has been awesome. Thanks so much for stopping by. We had a bunch of stuff we didn't even get to, but yeah. Next time. Any final stuff to plug or anything our listeners should check out?
No, I don't. It's been really great. Look forward to our next visit together.
Awesome. Take care.
Marketing Trends Podcast is brought to you by Salesforce. Discover marketing built on the world's number one CRM, Salesforce. Put your customer at the center of every interaction. Automate engagement with each customer and build your marketing strategy around the entire customer journey. Salesforce. We bring marketing and engagement together. Learn more at salesforce.com/marketing.
You have 8 seconds to capture the attention of your audience. 8 seconds to make a connection or risk a click away, a swipe, or a scroll to the next topic. This difference lies in your ability to deliver relevant experience to your audience across devices and across channels. But delivering on a really great experience is impossible without the right people and the right technology. You've got the right people, but your technology choices make or break someone's experience with your brand. I talk to CMOs all the time within the Fortune 1000, and I know how important this is at the center of gravity for your entire digital experience. Brightspot Content Management System can deliver relevant content, personalized experiences, and cross-channel synergies to create unforgettable brand experiences so you can be a bright spot in someone's day. From global crisis to hunger relief efforts to natural disaster preparation, the messages you deliver save lives. They also inform important decision-making and help keep communities safe and sound. The speed and scale of your content needs to be delivered faster and more precise and on a much larger scale than ever before. Brightspot Content Management System is already supporting some of the world's largest organizations to communicate on a global scale. From Johnson & Johnson sharing breaking news stories about its COVID-19 vaccine, to helping Whole Foods tell their brand story to audiences around the world. Brightspot is designed to handle rapid iteration and personalized messages to those you really care about most. Learn more at brightspot.com/marketingtrends.